to start now, because at least three of you were not here the last 2 days. Use about 5 minutes as introduction, which for some of you will be review, and then as people have gathered, we'll move on. We are for 5 days in a book study. The book is Religion and Violence. It is dated, meaning it's in the middle of the Vietnam era. I find that as I'm reading it again, and I don't know how many times I have read it, that it is more comprehensive than I had remembered. I think it's got an awful lot of good things in it. There are many places on a page where I now realize that he is covering a fairly broad issue, doing it rather well, giving you some options. I, again, am impressed with Robert McAvee Brown as a teacher. Let me review for you some of the primary things that it's trying to do. It has a limited audience, but we are the audience, white citizens of the United States of America. He's not trying to speak to all the issues of Christianity and violence. He's aiming for a broader audience, and that is Judeo-Christian, a biblical perspective, but not necessarily only a New Testament or a Christian perspective. He has as his primary thesis in regard to violence that we have to broaden our understanding of violence. We have to expand our understanding of violence if we're going to understand the world today. He does that with two teaching devices and two different people. One is A Spiral of Violence, Dom Elder Camara. The Spiral of Violence, which Camara, who is a bishop in Brazil, still is. I have a picture in the most recent thing about that conference of priests. The basic violence is injustice. And there you don't talk about acts of violence, you talk about states of violence, situations of violence. When there is a basic state of injustice at some point and points in the history of the world, it exploded. And then you talk revolt. And when it explodes, it usually is lashing out at that which has been the power structure, so you can expect the third part of violence, and that is repression. You try to put down the revolt. Camara's point is, we use the word violence usually only at points 2 and 3, only at the explosion, instead of seeing that injustice, that state of violence, was that which finally bubbled up. And until we see that first level of violence, we're not really going to get at root causes. The other one is it Garvey? No, you're the one who read the name the other day.
I'm seeing it, yeah.
Garvey. And that's 4 points. Overt and covert, and individual or personal and broader group under each one of those. The first dictionary definition of violence, and Tom and Becky had it at Vespers, Tom hit Becky, an overt act of an individual act of aggression. I hit you. If you institutionalize that or broaden it, you have like war, where we've all decided for overt group violence. Covert would be to violate the personhood of somebody. This can be psychological, it can be when I demean you, it can be language, it can even be if I block you out and as far as I'm concerned, you're dead and I don't have anything more to do with you, if I violate your personhood. The fourth level then is the institutionalized covert violence. And I'm saying Brown is talking mostly about that, the situation in the world today. Let me give you another way that we can be clarifying terms, which I think is important. He quotes Pope Paul the VI on page 47. If you're keeping the book, you can mark it. If you're not, don't mark it, because if you're going to give it back to me, I want other students to find it for their own and not already have all the answers marked. Middle of the page. If you want peace, work for justice. Pope Paul VI. Then, right underneath the quote from the conference of priests, If the Christian believes in the capacity for peace to bring justice, the latter is an inescapable condition for peace, namely, justice instead of injustice. This is a healthy reminder to those who think simplistically of peace as no more than the absence of war. If Brown had done a similar task on the word peace, which he did with the words religion and violence, he would have gotten into what I now have on the blackboard. In our common English usage of the word peace, now take it out of Holden Village discussion theologically. In fact, take it out of the church, if you can, for a minute. Common vocabulary among neighbors with the word peace. What's the first meaning of it in the United States today, in our English language, outside of biblical discussions?
No war.
No war.
The absence of war. It does come primarily from Pax. We get the primary content in Webster's Dictionary from the Latin Pax, and it is, first of all, the absence of war. The same word that brings us pact, P-A-C-T. It's an agreement not to fight. That's the primary. There's you can't say to somebody, that's really not what peace means. It is what peace means. Therefore, the first dictionary definition is, after the absence of war is the root of it, calmness, tranquility. These are very legitimate uses of peace. What Brown could have done is to go biblically to the concept of shalom in the Old Testament, later Irenae in the New Testament, but shalom is what gives it the content, and it is anything but the absence of war. It is a justice word. It is a communal concept. It's a social concept. Shalom and Irenae are used 350 times in the Bible, so it's a thoroughly biblical word. It's one of the richest biblical words that there is. And in all 350 uses, it is never individual or inner tranquility. It's a social concept. Well, if we're going to be thinking biblically, and our whole understanding of peace has already been determined by the dictionary definition of calmness, tranquility, and primarily the absence of war, we almost have to find another word. I mean, if I'm going to preach on a Sunday morning to people for whom peace already has all those words, all that meaning, and I keep using it, and I'm thinking this, we're just talking by one another all the whole time. That's all I'm trying to say. Biblically, the richness, the reason the prophets could say, peace, peace, where there is no peace, is precisely what I just tried to illustrate. That people were talking about peace when there was no war, or talking about peace when they were inwardly tranquil, and the prophets consistently in the Old Testament had to say, there is no peace, meaning you are oppressing the poor. Almost every time after a discussion like that, you'll have some description of crushing the poor. Meaning, you don't talk about a shalom community if anyone there has to say, I don't have enough to get by today. If we were Jewish people and I greeted you this morning and said, is it shalom with you today? The first meaning that you and I both knew we meant was, do you have enough money? I wish we could be as free about understanding that that's part of God's shalom. It is. All right. But we also knew, if we were good biblical people, that if we went around our world today and two-thirds of the world said, no, I don't, that you don't then talk shalom, shalom in glowing terms. It's not shalom. That's a biblical understanding. I don't think Brown maximizes that as much as he could. He starts by saying, we've got some common denominators. That's why we're talking about religion and violence. We've got some values that we share, a Judeo-Christian tradition. I think he could have reverted back more in this section. He does it, but he could have reverted back more to us as biblical people in making that point, that we really don't say, this, it's not a violent world right now just because we're not hitting one another. It's a violent world if 2/3 of the people go to bed hungry tonight. That's a violence. And we're called to bring God's shalom into the midst of it. Let me do one other thing in the way of background, and then we'll move ahead. There's the little man that I talked about yesterday. Why don't you pass that around briefly? 5'5" in Adler elevator shoes. Little man. Bishop Recife, I'm not sure, I'm not Spanish enough. R-E-C-I-F-E, is that right? Recife?
Recife,
all right. Did not choose to live in the bishop's palace, lived in the barrio or in the poor section, has been an advocate of God's people, basically God's poor people, and has consistently been an advocate for social change coming through nonviolence. He was part of that conference in 1968 that Gary said yesterday, it's a tragedy that we didn't know more about. And in this article, Sojourners, by the way, is a good magazine. We get it here at the Village. It started out to be the Post-American, started in Chicago. Now the group lives in Washington, D.C. Jim Wallace is the editor. He has a book in our bookstore called An Agenda for Biblical People. The managing editor, Wes Michelson, was an administrative assistant to Mark Hatfield before he moved into the Sojourners community. It's a radical group, radical in that they take the Bible more seriously than most, more seriously than most Christians. That's the basic meaning of radical, going back to the roots. And because they're so thoroughly biblical, they come down in stances that are in common terminology, radical in social and economic issues. It's an interesting mix, radical evangelicals. They live together in a community near where the Community of Christ was, where Mary and I and our family lived for a while, and we have a lot of mutual friends, but I don't know either Jim Wallace or Wes Michelson personally. Anyway, the 10-year anniversary of that conference is being held this year. In 78, they're having another gathering of the priests. And he is saying that there is pressure on them, that they have the accusations which they knew they'd get, namely that it is now communist, that he thinks that the major reason he has hopes for the conference is that there are so many people praying for it and that the Holy Spirit is still in charge of his church. It's a brief statement, but that group will meet again. The other thing that you will find in Sojourners this time is that the World Council of Churches just made a grant under its program to combat racism. And this time it's in Rhodesia. And the criticism has come that they are paying for the inciting of violence and are funding violence. And if you read the two chapters today, that's an old story. And it's still a controversial one. And I guess I'm hoping that our 5 days together give you some insight into why that's being done, why that's controversial, some insight into an understanding of the criticisms of that. The understandings of the criticism of that primarily assume that violence is the guerrilla movements in African countries, not the apartheid system under which those people had lived before. In other words, to fund violence, and I don't want to fund violence either. I mean, I think that there are two sides to that issue, and I think sometimes the money does get in the hands of those who killed Christian missionaries. I certainly don't want to condone that. What's missing from the criticism and the analysis, however, is just as much condemnation of the apartheid system, that if it didn't kill Christian missionaries, and maybe not even kill blacks, it kept them in that desperate situation of suffering without hope that we talked about yesterday. That it doesn't grasp the understanding of violence that Brown is trying to tell us. I can't tell by your faces whether that's so obvious that you don't need to nod so early in the morning that you don't know what I said, or so subtle that you're frowning at me. Are you with me in the last thing I said?
Yeah.
Okay.
What was the other half of that suffering without hope? That was good discussion yesterday.
Mm. All right. Yesterday's discussion said, there are some people who say we should not hold back our support of the South African government, or we should not let those present systems collapse because it's just going to be utter chaos. In fact, if South Africa collapses, those Soweto blacks who come in today and want the end of the apartheid system are at least getting their daily food out of jobs that will go if the government collapses. That's a legitimate point to raise. And sometimes people naively say, let the American economic system collapse. Let it go. Let General Motors go. The first ones to suffer are going to be Appalachian people who went up to work on the assembly line, not the president of General Motors. Don't be so naive about who's going to suffer first. That's the kind of argument that comes. The blacks in South Africa, answer to that, if the government goes, if the United States, Britain, and other countries put restrictions on and sanctions and what have you, yes, we will suffer. Maybe in the outside world's picture of it, we would suffer more than we are right now. We don't think so. We would be suffering with hope. Right now, we're suffering without hope. And even the physical death is and dying for a cause or whatever is not as painful, and this is Bishop Awala and Manus Buthelezi and other Lutherans in South Africa, is not as painful as suffering without hope. Right now we have no hope. That is trying to get inside an understanding of the present system being a state of such violence that people have that kind of pain, that they would want chaos and collapse rather than the present pain of suffering without hope. I don't know how you can get into that other than hear them and try to feel what they're saying. Okay? Brown does what we should have done if he had not done it. And that is chapter 5. He says, this is where we are. An interlude for stock taking, or where is the argument leading us? So you that have not been here before, if you can share a book with somebody, we'll just summarize where we've come so far in the book, and then we go on from there. Page 55. Briefly summarize, the argument goes something like this. Violence in our day is much more widespread than we like to admit. It is present not only in obvious overt physical acts of destructiveness, like war, but also in more subtle forms of violation of personhood that characterize the structures of our society. 2, the victims are a majority of the human family. We tried to point that out by saying the United Nations now talks about not only third world, but third world, fourth world, fifth world. And it would be more fair, it would be more accurate to say the two-thirds world instead of the third world. Then you would feel that group you're talking about, that sounds like a little minority when you say the third world, you're really saying the rest of them. But it's two-thirds of all the people who live. So you would understand that you're talking about the majority of the world, not the leftovers or something, after you've talked first world, second world, third world. 3, those who enjoy the advantages of the present structures are a minority of the human family. 4, the pressures for fundamental change will continue to develop. I guess some of these are debatable. Some of them you could have research. For instance, is it true that the poor people of the world are a majority? Well, that's a statistic. You find it out. You can argue with him, I guess. Then we do research. The fourth one is the kind that I guess is a judgment, but I think you take some past history, you take some present indication of the pressures, and he makes the statement as a statement like he does the other ones in there. 5, to the degree that change continues to be resisted by the exploiting minority, we can be sure that means for achieving change will move toward the employment of widespread physical violence. Namibia would be a case in point. Namibia has, let me just give you a little bit of background, because I want this week to at least include your understanding of that situation so that you begin to have an interest in it when you see it in Time magazine and other places. It is the location of some of the worst suffering in the world today, the worst oppression in the world today. 87% of Namibia is black. Half of those are Lutheran. Most of those in Ovamboland with Bishop Leonard Awala as their bishop. They have been non-violently resisting that oppression for a dozen years or more, and thoroughgoing non-violence. It's an exciting and inspiring thing. I mean, I've talked to Mati Amadila, a pastor of Namibia who's a seminarian at CAP, and the amount of suffering that they have that they do not say publicly is just, I mean, it's just amazing that they, without bitterness, well, there's anger, but without bitterness and without resorting to violence, have waited for a way that might change. In a film strip, a Namibian says, some of our people say we should do like you did in 1776 and use violence to gain your freedom. But we believe in Jesus, and we believe in peace, and we long for peaceful ways. It just does me in to hear this native saying, we have arguments that we should be like you, but we really want to do it peacefully. I mean, it's an inspiring thing. All right. There is more and more, as the reasons for a just war come when the last resort, remember the criterion for just war? You've tried everything else. You've tried the peaceful ways. You could argue in Namibia today, in our chapter today is, could there be a just revolution? That they have been patient, that they have tried, that they have appealed to the United Nations, that they have indicated dishonorable conduct on the part of, lies on the part of the South Africans in using their power, that they were told to rule Namibia for the best interests of the Namibians, and they have instead exploited the resources. You could talk to the fact that the international pressure has said that the Namibians have the right to complain, that the rights are on their side, and all of that. The longer it goes on and the oppression gets worse, the more you'll have people say, it won't happen this way. It'll have to be done with violence. And the more you'll get people who are in SWAPO, or Southwest African People's Organization, or others, that say, you've got to do it by violence. The longer that sits, the more the tendency will be to have a violent way, because they're suffering without hope. Now, we have a new point, at least as far as Brown is concerned, and that's point 6. The decision about whether such change comes peacefully or violently rests in large part with the minority, those in power. He is saying what we do or don't do will determine whether or not the revolution is violent or nonviolent. So we, in trying to find our role, which we said we were going to do tomorrow, this is now a primary factor in Brown's argument, that we will determine largely whether or not it's violent or nonviolent. And 7, the relinquishment of power will mean basically the creation of a more just society in which disparities between rich and poor will be narrowed, if not eliminated. We've already said, historically speaking, there are not cases in history where those in power gave up the power. The cases in history are where those who didn't have the power finally took it in some form. But Brown is a fairly hopeful man. He has the options and the alternatives, and still thinks that there is reason to say that it can be done nonviolently, and Namibians still say that it can be done nonviolently. And there are other parts of the world that we can talk about. But anyway, that's his summary up to now. Do you want to pause at that point and Had he brought you to these steps? I don't mean to agree with all of them, but is it an accurate description of where you feel we were in the midst of all of that? And now, what do you have to say about it before we move on?
Namibia is the African name for Southwest Africa.
That's correct. That's correct. That's the name they've chosen, and it's still illegal for them to use it there.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. They have to say Southwest Africa. One of the breakthroughs was for America, for U.S. people to petition a tuna company to put on the can Namibia instead of Southwest Africa, because they had gone along with South Africa. So that's the kind of progress. Those are little steps, but yeah, it means shield or protector, the word Namibia in their language. Southwest Africa, correct.
It's like Rhodesia has an African name.
Yes, correct.
John, I was a little disappointed in point seven.
All right.
Because I felt like he kind of carries us with him through the argument, but then when he starts talking about what would happen if there were a revolution, he's very, very, there's a lot of wishful thinking, it seems to me, and he doesn't make very clear what he envisions would be this romantic, beautiful outcome where all the human brotherhood lived in peace, et cetera, et cetera. Where the power would be shared, individual groups have a say in creating their own destinies rather than being manipulated. What kind of a dream is this? What kind of a vision does he have of the future? And can that really be pulled off? Is that the model we want for society?
He admits that the bridge between 6 and 7 mm-hmm. is what's so hard to achieve. Have you finished the book?
No.
All right. He does speak to those in the last two chapters. Okay. I mean, he speaks to some options. If he were writing the book today, I think he would be, if your idea was to reform the system, then I think he'd say you would join Bread for the World. And I don't think he's going to criticize anybody's finding their place to contribute toward that. If you were interested in United Nations Day, as we were in the village yesterday, he would be saying the special sessions of the United Nations, like the special session that talked about economic justice. If you want to work through the United Nations, you would be working for the United Nations new international economic order, which is really saying that we are globally interdependent, and we have to realize this for all of our sakes, and you would still be having some hopes in the United Nations. If you were instead of reforming the system, you were using nonviolent means, you would be a happy disaffiliate. You'd live in America and be a happy disaffiliate from materialism and from the